It's
We're
a very
gonna start.
Tricky
We're gonna
place.
Go live, okay?
All right, fucker.
All right. So, I mean, look, sexism in the watch industry, men versus women. I'm gonna read it as is, okay, from the person who sent it. And to clarify the nepotism.
Are we live?
Yeah, we're going live. I'm just going live right now. I'm just gonna trim it as is. I'm just gonna adjust it.
Wait, just let me know when we're live.
We're already live.
We're already live.
We're already live right now.
Oh, thanks for the heads up. All right, cool.
So sexism in the watch. What?
I said, what's up?
Sexism in the watch industry, men versus women. To clarify the nepotism aspect of the watch industry, long story short, this individual sent, their CV to countless companies. Long story short, everyone's saying they're impressed by the training and would love to have them on the company, but they're not hiring. Only to find out later on that, you know, these companies hired like three of this person's fellow graduates or classmates. So long story short, she's asking to clarify the, you know, or at least our opinions on the sexism in the watch industry, you know. You can tackle this if you want to.
That is a very touchy subject. But listen, the figures show for themselves. Watchmaking is clearly predominantly a male skills tradesmanship. In the past, females in Switzerland, females, you know, the rhodium girls, like they were good for specific tasks. I know a few female watchmakers myself, but you know, only literally about like maybe two handfuls of female watchmakers that I know that are in the industry, right? So for every like 10 males, there's probably one female or two or three if we're lucky, right? Because Swatch Group has a couple females, or had a couple females. But yeah, I mean, it's pervasive throughout the industry. So, you know, it's one of these things where the figures kind of show for themselves. What are your thoughts, Anthony?
I think it's a systemic issue. I think it's when you primarily look at the early days of watchmaking, for the most part, it was really, I mean, the concept of men bringing home the money and women staying at home for the most part. And then you have to factor into account that at the time, if bringing home the money means work and watchmaking was the only form of work, go figure that most of the people in the industry are predominantly males, right? I mean, when you think of a watchmaker, what do you expect? What's the first image in your head? It's always some sort of white-haired, old guy who's close to retirement, who's about to croak, and you know that's your typical idea of a watchmaker. And then you factor those into account, and then it's not just in watchmaking too. In almost every single industry, there's sort of some sort of sexism between men and women, which is why if you ask my honest opinion, I think in times like that, like especially now, you know, if you're a woman, if you're a female and you're in the watchmaking industry, you are already in just having those, just being a woman in watchmaking already sets you out from everybody else. On the opposite side, it also puts a lot of a burden on you. You know, you have that much more obstacles to overcome. If you are able to overcome it, then, I mean, you'll be a dime in a dozen, you know, you'll be, you know, at the top of the top.
But listen, also to add to that, like, I know also on that same token, like amazing female watchmakers who I worked with personally that have become so disenfranchised with the entire kind of watchmaking industry, the profession, that they end up leaving, right? Like, they went through the whole process of schooling. They went through all the certification training. You know, I worked with them, you know, and then they've just come so kind of fed up with the system that the same opportunities are not presented to them,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, yeah, I mean, it's like that's what you said. It's a systemic issue across every industry that obviously should be addressed, right? Because I personally have went to some of these watchmakers with issues that I couldn't solve and that they saw something that I didn't see, right? So, you know, there's something to it, right? That's not being addressed. And their aspect is critical and important for growth of watchmaking. for the future of watchmaking.
Let me ask you this: in the span that you've worked out in the field, how many female watchmakers have you come across?
Personally, let me see. I don't know. Like within Swatch Group, there was literally like maybe under 10 watchmakers I know. When I was AP, there was at least, I think, 2, if I'm correct. No, 3.
Okay.
4. Yeah, at least like maybe under 20 that I like physically spoke to, talked to, and worked with.
Now, when I say in the industry, I mean as watchmakers, not in other departments. So, like, not any sort of sequential work or departmental work, but, like, as a watchmaker. You know, like, I'm not saying some, like, a female that actually works in, like, quality control.
No. Okay. I work, I mean, just take a look at Swatch Group in itself, right? Like, when I was with them, it was, I mean, I can remember at least, like, 5, 6. Yeah, maybe 7, under 10 in Swatch Group. And then when I was at Audemars Piguet in Clearwater, there were at least, at least maybe under 5, you know?
Well, for me, I only know about 9 female watchmakers.
You only know about 9?
9.
In total?
In total, that I've ever worked with. Or that I've had the luxury of speaking with.
That's included. Oh my God! Really?
9. That's why I mean my numbers are very low. Like, and I've been to these companies. I've only seen 9. Even when I've visited some of these companies, I'm accounting for those people too. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, I've only seen 9. And of those females that I've worked with, even in the workplace, because you got to remember, a lot of the watchmakers are old school immigrants. So they have a lot of them either have a very chauvinistic perspective, or if they're not chauvinistic, they have a very male dominant personality, I guess. You know what I mean? Like sometimes they'll hurl, like, I mean, they won't get away with it today, but. You know, in the they'll hurl, like, flirt, you know, they'll flirt around at the workplace just jokingly, you know, like all that stuff. They wouldn't get maybe they will, simply because the workplace is just filled with like old school immigrants. And so they're not going to run to HR, you know what I mean, and complain. Whereas, you know, nowadays, in the new generation, some people might not to say that they'll run to HR, but some of them might voice their concerns or voice their objections, right? But yeah, only about 9
this
females that I actually, you know, I think we both know one already too, you know what I mean? But like,
shout out.
Nah, but it's tough, man. Like I honestly feel in situations like that, like, of course we can all complain and, you know, say this and say that, but I honestly think that if it's a female that's listening to this, you know, podcast, it should give you that much more motivation and inspiration to work that much harder, honestly. Even though you shouldn't need to, I'm not going to object that. I'm not saying that you should, but what I'm trying to say is that you'll stand out more. You know, it's just that extra obstacle you're going to have to go through. And it's easy for me to say because I know nothing about it, honestly. So I'm not trying to say I do.
And for that female listener, please send me your resume because I can probably get you placed, or I could throw your resume around to different watchmakers, yeah.
But exactly.
Send it my way.
You know, like, and this is great. Thank you for the person who submitted this. I honestly think that this isn't talked about enough in the industry. I mean, there's a lot of things wrong with this industry, honestly, that a lot of people don't hear about.
And this is probably why I'm gonna get all my parts account revoked. They're like, oh, Henry said what?
Revoked.
Okay. Denied.
Blah, blah, blah. And then speaking of which, let me see. I'm trying to find something that's related to this. Okay. Well, how about this? We can only go in vaguely about this, but we can talk about income. Because this is a question. I know it's tough.
Okay.
But hey, this is why we were tackling some of these things. would you consider this discussing this in this podcast? I know it's not the most pleasant topic of discussion, but we'll be interested in hearing your thoughts. What do watchmakers earn in service center, independence, production, and overseas in terms of salary, income? And just between you and me, we can go very, very vague in this. We don't have to go specific.
I'm going to give numbers, but the numbers I'm going to give are like, it's a far range, right? It's a vague range depending on where you place on the spectrum of things. So some watchmakers start off like doing piecemeal stuff, making like $30,000 a year. I mean, no one kind of like points the fact that watchmaking, like every other profession, needs, you know, you need to make your employer money, right? So they account for this like by giving you bare minimum wages, and then they you get kind of go piecemeal, right? So for every movement you service, you get maybe additional $50, $75, $100, and depends on the type of movement you service. Yeah. So and that's kind of like on the bare, like that's kind of like the chop shop kind of like watchmaker, right? And you have service center watchmakers where if you're coming out of school, you can make. And it depends also on what year you came out of school, too, because there were times where watchmakers were getting
a shit ton of money. Jesus.
Starting was, like, I think 55, but then, like, it also became, starting also became 45. And then depending on what company you work for, you're starting to be also 65.
Yeah.
And if you have some experience, you can kind of place between the 70 to 80,000 range per year, right? So it all highly depends on where you are on the spectrum of things.
Yeah. See, like, I agree with you. I think from my experience, and even if you just look at your respective countries in terms of like the bureau statistics, I think in the United States the average is about like 35 to 50, give or take, for entry level, 30 to 50 for entry level watchmakers. And like what you said, that could be base salary, right? So if someone freshly came out, your base salary, it could be more or less. So please don't go to your employer and say, look, this is what these guys said. But at the same time, like what you said, usually these are base salaries, and then sometimes there's a split in work. Either you're judged by your production value or the quantity of the work that you do. So if you're doing production work, that means you make extra money per extra pieces that you service from start to finish. If you're doing by numbers and quantity, then that means you don't get extra money for any work done, but they're rating you by the number of watches you can get out in that week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on that note, like, you know, if you're starting, then if you're just getting into the industry, it's hard to negotiate your salary, but
yeah.
when you're more established, you're more comfortable working on watchmaking, you know, please, like with every profession, go in knowing your cards, knowing what cards to play, and ensure that you're negotiating adequately so that you feel like you're compensated properly.
Now, I
right?
have
because,
a, yeah, you say?
Go ahead.
Okay. I was saying, I have a theory in why that number for starting watchmakers is low. And I feel like it's really because of the whole immigrant mentality. You know, like there's always going to be a watchmaker that's willing to undercut another watchmaker in terms of pricing. You know what I mean? Like if you look at the, if you look
that's
at
like
the,
then well, in every industry, that's like then every industry.
That's
right?
more, but
like,
this
so...
is more so for, I feel like this is more so predominant. This is more so extremely relevant watchmaking. Like,
yeah. But here's the thing, also, the funniest thing, like, some parts of the world, like, watchmakers live and make a comfortable salary, right? But they're also paying high taxes, and that's why their salary is also so high, right? Mm-hmm. So, but here's the thing, the United States, there's no, and I was talking to a buddy of mine, Chad, about this, and we were in California together, I think maybe the last year, was it January 2019, that, like, I was in California visiting Chad and a buddy of mine in LA, and there's no unions. There's no representation for watchmakers, so that we could ask for like a basic living salary, right? Like we can ask for a basic salary where we can cover costs and not have to like drive an Uber after working
you
8 hours a day.
Let me find out you drive an Uber.
Yeah, that Asians and cars don't mix. No, I'm kidding.
Oh boy.
Yeah,
but well, the reason why I say this is because I feel like if all the starting watch or if all watchmakers demanded a higher price point, it just helps everybody else because that just raises the bar for entry level. Now, this might be more of a burden on these brands and these companies to pay more for watchmakers, but that just creates more. I mean, this is like late. This is like decades down the line. But if you want the industry to grow,
here's the thing. This is how they've gotten away with it, right? This is because it's everyone in the States are so siloed off. No one talks about how much.
Exactly.
Right? Because like you can have the same 5 years experience as the guy next to you, but you know during negotiation you were kind of a crap negotiator who didn't know how to value your skills, and you're getting paid $10,000 less. You know.
But I feel like, I mean, most of the people who go into the industry are like that. They'll take what they'll take what's given to them. You know what I mean? Like that's why I said like I feel like this started with like that immigrant issue where a lot of these people who came here, they just wanted to make a living and you know, they didn't care about making as much as they can. They just came here and wanted to make sure they had you know, a salary to put food on the table. You know, so like even if this one person has 20 years of experience, they might not ever negotiate their salary, or they might not ever ask for more, or they might not ever demand more, which then sets the precedent for other incoming watchmakers. Because they're like, well, if this guy has 20 years of experience, then this new guy definitely shouldn't get paid as much as this guy. Yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, of course.
So I mean, that's where my thoughts and feelings are on the topic. And if you look at any growing industry or any growing sport or anything like that, the way these people make more and more money is by having and demanding more and more and creating that set point.
Upward mobility, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's
exactly
why people leave other companies so that they like. So the example I can use is some people work in certain companies kind of like as a training ground. You do your 5 years there, and then you go somewhere. You take all that skill, years of experience and training that was provided, and you just bring it somewhere else. That I feel like it's a shame, right? Like you shouldn't have to want to leave. I mean, if you're comfortable somewhere and they're paying you a good wage, I mean, negotiation should always be open for situations like this, right? And it comes to show you sometimes, maybe like every other trade, you know, watchmakers are replaceable, right? Like every other profession, right? And I hate this sounds very capitalistic of me and very like, it's very like one-dimensional, but you know, sometimes people are unreasonable with their demands, right? And that's why people, instead of having a negotiation, they're like, fuck it. It's either all or nothing. Either you stay at this range or it's nothing, right? Mm. So yeah, that's my take on it. And I gave enough figures, so hopefully everyone kind of gets the idea, you know? And obviously, you know, in Sweden, in kind of like Icelandic and European countries, you're going to make a bit more, but the additional income is to essentially cover the insane amount of taxes that you would have to pay.
I mean, the way I see it is this. I mean, look at boxing. I mean, Mike Tyson, before Mike Tyson came on board, nobody ever made that much money in boxing. Whereas when Mike Tyson came onto the scene and he created that new set point, then that was a new barrier, new standard for these purses. And every generation is supposed to raise that bar. You know, I don't know. I feel like that's equivalent to what I'm trying to say. If that makes
I get what you're saying.
More clear.
But that works in boxing because there's a commission. Right, I mean, there's an actual committee and a commission in boxing that sees this kind of stuff. They might not like it, but like they'll have to deal with the each of the commission's fighters. Right, so this goes back to like unionizing, like having a voice. Like there's no one watchmaker, there's no central, there's no leader. Right, look at unions for like carpenters, electricians. You know, I mean, just take NYPD, for example. They have a union, right? The union rep speaks for NYPD, right? All this stuff happens because you're protected by the union. I mean, one industry of very few people that does not have a union, and I believe it was blocked when, like, people mentioned it or brought it up. So
the way I see it is, I mean, look, there's not many watchmakers.
Every other skilled profession has unions, right? And then when you get into the union, back in the days, you were set for life, right? Like you union for like woodworking, electrician, you know, fire department probably has their own union, right? Like building management in New York has unions, right? So once you're in the union, you're essentially covered, right? But that's not the case for watchmaking.
Yeah,
we don't have enough numbers. There's like not enough like member dues or something. But I feel like that's one step to creating a more baseline and a more systematized approach to watchmaking.
I mean, I feel like on top of that, like there's not many watchmakers globally speaking, so it shouldn't be that hard to even just get everyone together. You're only talking about, I don't know, several thousand, 5,000.
I think in the States, United States itself, there's under 1,000 watchmakers.
No, not under 1,000. Yeah. I'll say like about 2,500 to 3,000 watchmakers in the United States.
We account, because worldwide, there's like about 6,000, no?
Yeah, give or take. They say worldwide, it's definitely less than 10,000. So, I mean, originally speaking, the numbers were around 5,000 to 6,000, I believe, globally speaking. And
so let's do the math. If we have 1,300 watchmakers in the States, and everyone pays, let's say, $1.50 a year, or let's say
Well, that's your thing. This comes back to my point. You're gonna have a lot of watchmakers that don't join because of the whole immigrant mentality. I mean, they don't want to do anything to disturb the water. You know what I mean? They disturb the waters. Like they don't want to rock the boat. You know, they just want to put food on the table, and they don't care about this. This is really more so for the newer watchmakers who know what they can and can't do, or are curious about what they can and can't do, and they're willing to push the envelope, whereas a lot of these older school watchmakers don't. And on top of that, this is really for brands that you're speaking about. Think about it like that. These unions will be against the brands in theory.
Yeah.
I mean, whereas most of the watchmakers are actually independent, or they work for a small family, you know what I mean? Or they work for like a small jewelry company. A family-owned company, an independent company. So what we're really talking about then would be against brands for the most part, because they're the ones who can get you that specific income. I don't know if this is even a feasible topic, because who's going to want to go against multiple brands?
I mean, if we keep it to that the brand has to go to one centralized location, the union, for workers, then... You know, like they'll have nowhere else to go. But I mean, that's kind of like this idea needs to be fleshed out way more, right?
Yeah. So, but I mean, these are just issues in the industry, honestly. But
yeah, and it's what you're saying is true, right? Like, and I kind of like what I'm suggesting is let's begin a discussion about this, right? If someone has ideas, let's, you know, shoot me, drop me a line. Like, you know, I'd love to kind of flush this idea out, because like this is one step towards a better future for future watchmakers, right?
Because yeah,
this is, you know, not for the group that's going to be retiring in a bit. This is more so for the group that's going to be leading watchmakers,
for the most part,
in the production houses, right? So, you know, that's the group that I'm kind of like calling out.
Yeah. Plus, it sucks, man. It really sucks when you find out the person next to you has less experience than you, and somehow they make more money than you. I can definitely understand that.
Yeah, I agree, because I've had the same experience, right? So it becomes very disheartening.
Yeah. All right. Well, next question. If I use the chronograph on my watch, does it drain the power reserve?
Is the next question going to be another depressing question? Because like I kind of see a trend here.
Nah, I don't know. I mean, look, these are just the questions that are coming in. I'm just answering them in order.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. If I use the chronograph on my watch, does it drain the power reserve faster?
Does it drain? You take the question, Anthony.
Well, No, it doesn't.
You take that question.
I will say no. The power reserve is the power reserve. Just the court. What you do have a problem with when it comes to, just think of it like this. Yeah, the only thing that happens when you turn on the chronograph is really just it adds more stress on the base movement. Or there's two different chronographs. There's one that's horizontal, the one that's called a vertical clutch, right? So if it's a horizontal attachment to it, then that means it just connects to a chronograph system. If it's a vertical, then what that usually means is that it's already built into the movement, into the base movement. So when you do turn on the chronograph, it engages everything that's already somewhat already engaged, already there. It's not attached. It's not an attachment. It's embedded in it. Now, when you turn on the chronograph, essentially what that does is just adds more stress, and it might cause your amplitude on your movement to drop. So it might cause the watch to run harder. It's taxing the movement harder in theory. Now, this is what I'm talking about. This is just purely for mechanical watches. If it's for quartz watches, then it might be a little different. If you turn on the quartz watch, it might drain the battery a little faster. In theory, it shouldn't, but it might, simply because there's more things it needs to operate. And it's just like running multiple programs on your computer. Think of it like that. But in terms of power reserve on a mechanical watch, no. I would say that it doesn't drain the power reserve faster. But what it does do is it taxes the movement harder, it might cause you to have a premature service earlier sometimes in some cases, simply because of all the mechanics that have to come into play.
I mean, take the Pas de Prix module, for example, right? That sits on top of a base at a movement that once you start it, either if you have a clean module, it'll run smoothly with the movement, or it will die down and run horribly if the module and the movement are not serviced correctly.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like every other service or like every other mechanical item has to be cared for and treated, right? Whether you run it or not run it, it's a function, you know? Like, personally, me, I like to run my chronograph just because it's a function of my watch, and I want to see the hands go spin, you know, or, like, move.
You mean your chronograph hand isn't your second hand?
Wait, it's not? Oh, my God. This is some life-changing podcast I'm on right now. I never knew that. No, I'm kidding. But, yes, so some people, like, are against it, or some people are like, hey, were you like, I stopped your chronograph, were you timing something? I'm like, oh my god, you just like ruined my entire day's like worth of timing. And then I'm like, no, I was just kidding, I was just messing with you. Like, I like to run it. So
see, I'm on the opposite spectrum. I don't really even use the chronograph on my chronograph watches. Like, I literally never even ever engage it.
Do you even wear a watch?
I mean, as of now, no, not really. I don't know. You just run watches for so long, you don't really even feel like wearing one. I don't know about you. Maybe I'm an oddball, but like the last thing I'll do when I come home is set my watch, or you know, or even the last thing I'll do when I wake up and before I leave the house is literally put it on a watch. But long story short, I feel like the chronograph. I mean, who really even need? Do you even use the watch to tell time anymore? You know what I mean? Like, besides certain professions, like, if your profession needs you to wear a watch, then yes, I wholeheartedly agree. You know, there are a lot of professions that still require you to have a watch on because you can't use your phone.
Yeah, some like heavy industrial places, you can't take your electrical phone inside.
Yeah, right? Of course,
so
I agree.
They depend
on the watch
solely on the watch, right? So that's why, you know.
But other than that, does your average Joe need a deep sea? Does your average Joe need a minute repeater? Does the average Joe need a chronograph? Because really, chronographs were invented for gambling. But your phone can. I mean, I use the phone for a stopwatch more so than I ever use a watch. Like if I'm working out, let's just say, and I want a stopwatch, if I need to start and stop something in terms of like a stopwatch, I use my phone. I don't even use the chronograph on the watch. I don't know. That sounds very depressing.
I mean, that's just me. I mean, to that same extent, you wouldn't even need a watch at all.
I don't,
because that's the most inaccurate way to tell time.
Yeah.
Why? Because there's a $1 billion industry or $1 trillion industry in ensuring that the time on your phone is synchronized with the correct time of the location you're in.
I feel like it's, I mean, really, it's just an accessory if your profession doesn't need you to do it, honestly.
I mean,
that's if you ask me. But anyway, that's a different tangent, I think. But look, if you have a chronograph, use it. If not, up to you. But
it's like for classic car collectors, right? Like, that's the most inefficient way to release gas.
True.
Right. But the car, it's a fucking nice car. It's a beautiful engine. It sounds great. The smell of it is beautiful when you sit inside. But it's the most inefficient like car ever.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful mechanical sight, right? So yeah.
Do you use your watch to tell time anymore?
Nope. Well, sometimes. So, all right, you guys are gonna hate me, but I wear an Apple Watch as well. So here's the thing, right? Like, it tracks my steps, it tracks my heart rate, it gives me metrics behind. Like, I'm a big metrics guy, right? So, like,
figure.
So it gives me insight into like my habits. So that's why. I wear the Apple Watch, and like I would also wear a mechanical watch.
I couldn't double fist two watches on the same hand or alternating.
It depends. Sometimes I have that like, you know, Apple Watch like as a watch, and then my watch on the other hand, just because I'll go to some events and I just like feel improper. Yeah. So I was like my right hand or left hand, like we'll have the mechanical watch and the other hand, like, or sometimes I'll put it up my forearm and I'll hide it in the dress shirt, right? Just I hide my Apple Watch, and then like when I like am rolling it up for drinks or food or whatever, everyone's like, "Hey, is that an Apple Watch underneath your shirt?" I'm like, "Yeah, you caught me."
I thought it's I was Apple bad. Watch. Shit, I would much rather not wear a watch at all than to.
Yeah, but I like the metrics and I also like something mechanical, right? Like I'm sorry, like I just like, you know, like I'm technically in theory not a big you know, as a digital watch guy, but I'm a sucker for metrics. So, and it syncs up with my iPhone, and it syncs up with my whole like computer network, because obviously I hate to say this again, but Apple. I'm going to sound like an Apple fanboy, but like I have like MacBooks, I have like iPhones, and I have the, you know, the watch. So,
oh boy,
it obviously makes sense for it to.
Let me ask you this.
For that.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that smartwatches is going to kill the industry like many people apparently forecast?
I mean, the forecast is like 5 years ago, right? Yeah. Like, come on. It's all complete bullshit, right? Like, if a person wants to spend a couple $100 on a Apple Watch, that helps. That reality of someone having something on their wrist helps our industry.
I completely agree.
Their next step is going to be, hey, let me look at a mechanical watch, right? Because all these, like, they call it, like, we call them dials, but in digital watches, they're called faces, right? I think
that's the dumbest shit ever.
They're like, hey, what kind of face do you have, you know? I'm like, oh, yeah, I have it looks like a fucking mechanical watch. Like, the face they choose has hands, has dials. Like,
yeah.
It looks like a chronograph, you know? I was like, okay, I guess that's the face you want, but...
Many, many hardcore, like, watchmaking guys will say, yes, they're killing it. Because, you know, they're not purchasing an actual watch from the industry. But I agree with you. I feel like these smartwatches breaks that barrier, that first initial barrier for people who would never wear a watch to... changing their mind to saying, okay, maybe I can see myself wearing this smartwatch. And in doing so, like you said, there's so many different dials available on the apps and whatnot that they start customizing and playing with it. And then it's logical for them they might reach that point where they're saying, look, this isn't that bad. You know, what about an actual real mechanical watch? So if anything, I feel like the smartwatch industry it's not a versus idea. It's not a like smartwatches versus, you know, the watchmaking industry. I think it's a separate category in theory. And it could actually help and benefit the industry. Yeah. I know a lot of people who've made that transition from smartwatches to actual real watches that would never have bought a real watch if they didn't have the smartwatch initial set.
Yeah, because think about it. If you want to spend like $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 on a watch, then you know, like if you weren't going to spend that money, but you spent a couple $100 on a digital watch, the next step, obviously, is to maybe, like, look at a mechanical piece. A cheaper one, not maybe, like, the higher price range, but then, like, it just begins their journey into something. And that's great, right? And if not, then they just have something digital on their wrist that they're comfortable with that, you know, is also good, right?
Yeah. All right, we'll move on to the next one. We got a good amount of questions today. What parts from Swiss watches are made primarily in China?
I've seen multiple aspects of this, right? Industry's gonna hate me, but for the most part, almost like close to everything, right? Oh. Like I cases, bracelets, dial, like some Swiss watchmakers go to, you know.
I could name several.
I don't want to name. But yeah, like,
you're going to get cease and desist letter.
I've gotten the box in the warehouse, like shipped from so-and-so. And they told me like, hey, they were like, take off the made in China label in the box.
That's illegal, like, no? Isn't that?
That has to be illegal.
I mean, for the most part, like I know a lot of companies use like Hong Kong and stuff like that.
No, but Hong Kong isn't the production house. Hong Kong is
what,
the
assembly? Meeting
point where, no. So here's the thing, right? Like, what people don't tell you is it's there's like maybe three or four. There's a handful of major factories in China that does the production. Hong Kong is like their New York City, their meeting ground. There's a big Hong Kong watch like fair and expo that everyone goes to because that's where you meet your suppliers, right? And it's through these intermediaries where a lot of this stuff gets done.
Now, isn't that illegal? I'm pretty sure there has to be X amount of percentage that is done in Switzerland for them to say Swiss made.
I think it's 60 or 50. Like, there's a percentage that was adjusted. But, like, I mean, if 50% of your watch is, let's say, a movement and case, like, what differentiates the components, right? If your entire movement was produced in Switzerland, is that 50%? No. Because without a movement, you wouldn't have a watch. You would just have a case.
So you're arguing that the movement's significantly more than 50%?
I don't know. I mean,
I know Shinola had gotten in trouble with the whole made in USA, and they had to change it to assembled in USA.
Yep.
This is like a long time ago.
The FCC's a bitch.
Yeah.
They will come after you if you like mislead.
Now, what parts?
Consumers.
What parts would you say are made? Would you say all the parts? Or
no?
Like,
I mean,
the common ones. Would you say crystal, case, dial? Like, what would you say?
I think case and bracelets, and dials and hands. I mean, because it's just so cheap. Like, it's just done so cheaply, right? Like, it would make, like, you're not selling a $60,000-$70,000 watch where, you know, you have a goldsmith or a case maker making you individualized gold links, right? So, and if you're selling a watch like under $1,000, I mean, it's hard to say it was, you know, like what a lot of people do is they get the stuff from Asia, they have the movements in Switzerland, and then they assemble it. Right, so now you have workmanship, now you have the movement, but the casing, you know, might not be Swiss made. So that's usually how I see, like, that's how people can say this was, you know.
Now, what are your thoughts
on the Swiss stamp?
What are your thoughts on Asian, like, these Asian caliber movements and watches? Like, do you think that they could be complete, like, tough competitors to the Swiss if the Swiss don't keep up?
No. I feel like they play at a different space.
What do you mean?
I mean, let's be realistic. Like, most Asian calibers, just because of the fact that they're Asian caliber, like, you know, from Asia, like, there's already, like,
a connotation?
Negative connotation that it's not going to be as on point with Swiss calibers, right? So, like, if you give me a Miyota, which keeps good time, and you tell, you know, you ask someone to compare Miyota to ETA, you know, 9 out of 9, they're going to go ETA, you know?
Of course. Now, but let me ask you this. Let's just say we put the connotations aside. Let's just say they're on an equal playing field, a double blind test, right?
If of timekeeping.
Yeah, like I'm just saying, like for example, like
yeah, the for sure. No. I mean, some Seikos keep better time than some amazing Swiss movements. So for sure, right? Like, I completely agree. If there's a double blind test and you're just only testing for timekeeping purposes, if you take like a low grade ETA and you compare it to like a low grade, you know, Miyota, Seiko, whatever movement, like you'll have majority of them keep, like, you know, better time. Or if not, they'll stay on point to their Swiss equivalent.
The reason why I bring this up is because I had made my perspective that if the Swiss don't keep up, that they might face extremely tough competition from Asian watches. I mean, look at Hong Kong, look at some of these individual manufacturers, like not like that are Asian made. I mean, look at the way they reverse engineer some of these fake watches. I mean, it looks really, really good. Now, if they were able, I mean, many would argue, like, why wouldn't they just create their own brand and do it that way? And I say, you know, that's not, because it's not guaranteed sales. But if they were able to channel that workmanship and all that reverse engineering and all that craftsmanship into creating their own brand, there's a huge possibility that they could be extremely, extremely tough competitors to the Swiss. I mean, they made the cheapest tourbillon. I mean, look at the tourbillon they've created for a tenth of the price of an actual Swiss tourbillon.
You know, I feel they go hand in hand, right? The Asian market, the Swiss market. Just like how, you know, a lot of people probably don't know this, but before Switzerland was this hot in watchmaking, it was America, you know? Like, I don't want to get political here, but, like, you know, America was the forefront and the leader in production. Like Hamilton, like, all these Swiss watchmakers came over to the Hamilton factories and kind of, like, Dan Fenwick and guys like of his caliber gave these people a roadmap of what to do, right? A lot of the factories, you know, paved the way for kind of how the Swiss industry is now, or that kind of production mindset, right? Because Hamilton in the U.S. in its heyday was the, you know, Swatch Group equivalent
in watchmaking. What would you say is the, what would you say this is the correlation with Asian movements, though? Like, why would they go hand in hand?
Well, because they support each other, right?
Asian?
Without
Asian system? Well,
yeah. I mean, think about where 90% of the sourcing of the components of a watch comes from, right? The industry is able to leverage cheap labor from Asian countries and then mark that up so that they can make value. And don't get me wrong, not everyone's like that. Some watchmakers are probably doing everything in-house. They have their own production factories and stuff. But for the most part, I mean, how do you manage sustainable growth if you don't leverage economies of scale? And if you don't leverage that, how does the Asian market grow? How does the Asian market leverage? How do they make such amazing movements and stuff if they didn't have help from, like, big R&Ds? Like, big research and development groups like Swatch Group or Richemont or whoever, when they're in talks with developing a new product line.
I can see your point. I can see your point there.
Yeah, so it's like you don't bite the hand that feeds you. So, you know, I feel like they I mean, yeah. It's you're talking more, this is more of a global economy, right? This is more of a global process of watchmaking.
I think globally, by putting economy and everything like that aside, if you just grab purely craftsmanship from Asia versus that of the Swiss, I think if the Swiss don't keep going up and up, that the Asian market will catch up.
I mean, there are some Asian watchmakers that are fucking amazing, right? Like, I personally know a handful of Asian watchmakers that are the hand-eye dexterity, like, in watchmaking it's just bar none, right? Like, and they're given the correct instruction, they're given a kind of a roadmap, you know, I feel like sky's the limit for them, you know? But, you know, to your point, I mean, if you're at the top, where do you have to go but down? I think about it like that.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like the Swiss should keep up. Is all I'm trying to say. They have to keep innovating, because at this point, I mean, all the releases they've done the past decade, maybe. I mean, it's like, compared to what you expect, it's not meeting client demands anymore. I mean,
in what way?
I mean, look at some of these watches that came out recently. Do you like any of them?
Sorry, I don't.
Well, no, some of these releases at Basel World, and some of these releases of it's just like, it's mediocre at best, and there's one or two that look really good, but aside from that, it's just like, it feels like all these companies are just reiterating the same thing over and over again in a different color. You know what I mean? Like,
listen, if you only came out with a black car, and then next year you came out with the silver and green and blue car, then it's a big deal, right? If that's what you got your clientele used to, then, you know, for them, obviously, it's a big deal.
I mean, what do you think about the AP watch that looks like a Hublot?
Wait, what?
Yeah, AP created a watch that looked like a Hublot.
Oh, no. Oh, I'm not trying to get brand specific here, because I don't get snacked and cease and desist, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean,
I'll let you tackle
it. It's just little things like that. I'm like, wow, really? You know, like, I feel like, don't get me wrong.
It's purely expressing our personal opinion here, you know, nothing to do with it. Yeah, okay.
Okay, anywho, actually, what are your thoughts on Seiko mods?
Seiko mod,
I guess.
The Grand Seiko?
I think this is generally speaking, because apparently there's a huge, network of people just doing Seiko mods. Like, really? it's a huge thing, apparently.
I never knew that.
Like, they change out the bezel, they change out the dial, they change out the hands.
Cool. Then I'm all for it.
Dude, what's with your background? I hear, like, a cleaning truck or some shit.
Sorry. Canal Street's pretty popular right now.
Oh. All right. Okay, next. Is Bergeron stuff overpriced, or are they just alone in their category?
As a watchmaker and as a person, I think it's overpriced. But some people might not, right? Like, that's the same thing as, like, you know, maybe they have some stuff, some secret sauce that they're developing in-house, but for the most part, it's like the watch industry, like the Swiss watch industry, right? They go to Asia, they get it, they come back, they slap that sticker, and they charge you twice the price, or maybe like five times the price.
Yeah, if you make anything that's watchmaking related, and you slap a watchmaking brand on it, it's expensive.
Yep.
Like,
and say it's from Switzerland. Oh, that's it. You're gonna pay out through your ass.
Yeah, like I had seen like there are a lot of nail salon tools that the watchmaking industry has just taken and just like slapped on a watchmaking logo on it and said, damn, let me 10x this.
That's how they make money, man.
Yeah, but I mean, there are other brands.
It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, there are other brands other than Bergeron that can actually create some of these products for a lot cheaper than what Bergeron charges. But unfortunately, because Bergeron has been like, it's in the industry for a long, long time, so they're really considered the number one because of that, like in terms of quality and whatnot. But
to be honest, like most large watchmakers, watchmaking industries itself, they have a percentage in Bergeron, right? They own a certain part of Bergeron that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why they, you know, have this kind of arrangement where I own part of you. So instead of giving money to another person or another company for parts, you produce the parts and we buy it, right? So it's a good.
Yeah, and they slap on their name on it and make you buy it.
I mean, as independent, you kind of like, you have to kind of do what the brand says for, they don't allow you the parts.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah.
Okay. Without a winding tool, any advice to winding the watch manually?
Get an eraser. Like winding it, like winding it like with the crown or like?
Yeah,
like,
the crown, I think. You say get an eraser?
Yeah.
How's an eraser help you? How's an eraser help you wind the watch?
You unscrew the crown, and you put the crown instead of trying to wind it with your hand. You rub the watch, the crown on the eraser, so you can wind the watch if you can't wind the watch with your fingers.
Oh, okay. So you're saying put the watch. So you're essentially driving the crown into the eraser and turning it.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I was about to say I'm thinking of like a regular eraser in the back of a pencil.
You're talking about an actual wide eraser. I used to know guys that would stick, the table mat on the side of the bench, like because that's a cushion. It's just a table mat's kind of soft and it doesn't scratch if you keep it clean. And they would like run the watch again on that. Like they would run on the side of the table so they can wind the watch if they couldn't get their fingers on it.
Really?
But I feel like the eraser or something soft rubbery is much more.
You do know that that actually like the real technical guys will tell you that the bench mat can't scratch your watch.
Yeah, but let's be realistic. Like, how many times have you scratched your watch because the bench mat is dirty, right? Unless you have a new bench mat every single time and can guarantee that there's no dirt and debris on it, you can't, right?
I mean, like, I've seen the studies from these brands. These brands have showed me, like, they said, like, the technical guys over in Switzerland, they show you, like, the micro detail of what a benchmark can do to your watch, which is why they recommend you always have a bench cushion, and of course there's always like that reality side of things, like, look, this is what the Swiss wants you to do, and sometimes that might not be feasible, and not that it's not feasible, but sometimes it's not always the most convenient or efficient way, but that's very Swiss. Yeah, very Swiss to tell you that this bench mat will scratch your watch.
It's their direct / indirect way of telling you have a dirty bench mat, clean and use this instead.
But yeah, I never thought about that, actually. That's a good idea. I actually never heard of using the watch to drive into an eraser or the bench mat. I know there's like tools where you can, push it out and it'll clamp onto the crown and you can twist it that way.
$5,000? Like, there's a mechanical Virgin sells a mechanical equipment that, like, you can attach your watch to and it could mechanically wind your watch.
Is it $5,000?
It's some crazy astronomical price that day. I mean, listen, if you need to do something with a watch, there's a tool for that.
Oh, shit. Well, I didn't know it was $5,000.
It's something along those lines. It's a crazy price, right, for it. And it's like, that's why I was like, I was talking to, Jaime Corpola about this, and it was like, watchmaking tools should not be this fucking expensive. Like, you should be able to produce the same results without having to pay these astronomical prices. But kind of therein lies the solution when you have to make profit margins because they're asking at the end of the year, they're asking why prices are so low.
All right. Where is a good source for information about watch calibers and parts?
Good source, like a free open source.
I'm not sure. I mean, this is just.
I don't have the free good open source. I have a source where you have to, either have an account with these companies so that they can open up their doors for you. I have stuff in the past where like I've personally worked on that I've kept notes on, but there's no like, it's not a free library. In some cases, because if you look at it, like most watchmakers, well, not watchmakers, but like most watchmakers, like Omega, Rolex, all these big brands, the brand watchmakers, like that's their IP, that's intellectual property, because that's their product, that's their secret sauce, right? So only their watchmakers, who are on a need to know basis need to know.
Well, look, unfortunately, I don't think there's any good source of information for about watch calibers and parts on the internet for a fact.
You can find old tech guys, right? Yeah. But they're in French and they don't really serve a purpose, right? They don't really serve or tell you how to fix the problem or service them properly.
I think, long story short, the stuff on the internet is really just speculation. Aside from what the brands put on their website and whatnot about the model and all that fancy promotional stuff, a lot of the other information about watch calibers and whatnot are from forums and from other people who are answering other people's questions. To get your information from sources like that is not always 100% accurate. It is a source, whether it's a good source, a valuable source, or a valid source, is very difficult to determine. The most accurate good source of information is directly from the brands themselves via the technical guide or via technical instruction books that they have. And only, like you said, are they available to you when you get those parts account. Now, there are some watchmakers who can reverse engineer and by following certain principles and concepts, when it comes to oiling or whatnot, they can follow a good rule of thumb. But in terms of watch calibers and parts, only these brands, specific brands and manufacturers have the direct information for exactly what it is. If in terms of good source, if that's what the person who's asking this question means, I would say go, if you can, get the technical document. Even if you can get the technical document, you want to make sure it's as updated as possible. Because if you get the older one, that's an old concept, and they could change every year. I mean, a lot of these brands nowadays, they have everything online for these watchmakers with specific logins to give them updates whenever necessary.
Yep, and that's completely true. And also, this is why there was, a bill or something that was trying to get passed through the Federal Trade Commission, where in the United States, you should say make parts available, readily available for watchmakers and other individuals to try to fix their watch, right?
Because
the whole issue is they have, the industry has a monopoly on that, because unless you have a skilled watchmaker who has the parts account, they can't readily get parts. They're not readily available for you to be able to work on them if you don't know, it goes back with fixing your own computer, fixing your own phone. Like, if your phone is broken, for the most part, either people trash it or they get a new one, right? Because no one looks to fix things anymore.
Well, I think I read the same thing you're talking about. I think that was it was an FTC case against Sony or Microsoft. I think it was in regards to an Xbox or a PS4 or something like that.
Because they have a sole monopoly on the product, right? Go ahead.
I think what ended up happening was that Either one of those two companies, I could even be wrong, it could be a completely different brand, but they had something where along the lines of if this is removed, then this voids all warranty. And I think that was the issue, because
the messed up part is, in order to fix the thing, you have to remove
exactly,
right? In order to regulate your watch, you have to open up the case back, or open up if it's a front loader, you open up the crystal or the bezel.
So I think this was a case. So then they made a huge case for this for the service industry, because for servicing and repairing things, and they were able to link it to watchmaking. So I think that's still in pursuit. I'm not sure if they concluded anything from that.
Okay, all right. So we'll move on to a next question. Make it a fun question, please.
Make it a fun question.
This has been so far
too technical.
Very, very, yeah, very, very watchmaking and not enough bullshitting.
Okay, I have one here. What is the funniest thing you've ever experienced in watchmaking? That's actually a good one too.
Okay, that is a good one. All right, so there's another car, the street cleaner coming through again. I think this guy is following me in the streets.
That's gonna be a meme. Garbage.
Well, at least the reception, I haven't dropped reception yet, but so
you're getting comments. So, you're getting comments of your dropped calls the entire time and shit.
you know, I was headed to an office. That's why the elevator cut it off, and I thought I could kind of like wiggle my way in. But yeah, no. So here's a funny story, right? So in a watch brand I worked in, it was assembly line process. There was like three benches, obviously, right? So like it was my bench, watchmaker B and C bench, right?
Okay.
So each bench has a Witchi machine. So one morning, like I'm in there like 7 o'clock in the morning in the shop already, like kind of start my day prepping and all that stuff. I swap out their microphones. So I would take Watchmaker B's microphone and put it into the Witchi machine of Watchmaker C.
Why the fuck would you do that?
And just the fuck with them.
But it shouldn't make a difference though, no? The microphone should still be the same. It should still work.
No, you don't get what I'm saying. So if you would time your watch, the other guy's Witchi machine would show.
Oh, you're saying you connected their watch? You connected the microphones across the benches?
No, right? Yes.
So you connected like Watchmaker A's bench to C and switched the microphone is what you're saying, right?
Yes. So every time he timed the watch, he wasn't getting a reading, right? And the guy was like, "What the?" And he's like, and then the other guy who wasn't reading it was like, "Why is there?" And then like towards like midday, they realized, "Fuck with them."
Oh, you. That's a dick move. You know.
And then, wait. I have another one.
Okay.
You know the hand presses. You know the ones where you have different pusher types for hands. Like it's color coded for like. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Like, one day I was messing with a watchmaker, so I swapped all their tubes or the plungers. Uh-huh. So when he was going to put his hour hand, it was fitted for second hand, right? So the guy was like,
"Oh, you're a dick. you're one of those dicks, huh?" Oh man. This is just the funniest pranks you've done. This is not even like what. These are pranks that you're doing.
You get fucking bored, right? Yeah, like you're doing the same shit with the same people, talking about the same shit, same problems. You know, so you gotta make the best of your day. And yeah, and for aspiring watchmakers out there, give it a try. Have a laugh.
I wouldn't say this is the funniest thing for me, but it happened to be the funniest thing for me, not purposefully, but the watchmaker, like we were working in the manufacturing time, a watchmaker in front of me was servicing a tourbillon, and there's windows in front of us. So it was in the middle of winter, and it was extreme. They pumped up the temperature in the workshop. So someone decided to prank everybody and raise the temperature to like 85, and it was like really, really hot. And in theory, I'm not gonna lie, in theory, you're not supposed to ever do anything like that because you actually destroy the quality of all the watchers. But this guy thought it was a nice and funny thing to do because he's a jokester. But he pumps up the temperature, so one of the guys is like notorious for being hot. So he just starts going berserk. Like he starts getting frustrated because the heat that's settling in. And when you're working, you don't really pay attention, but you just start to feel like a little hot and whatnot. And once you start feeling that, sometimes you start getting more anxious and more like a temperament. So what ended up happening was this guy started getting upset, and it coincided with when he was working on a specific complication. So he was getting really mad, and it gets to the point where he's like, he's going to go and open the window. So he rushes over to the window in front of this other guy who's working on a complication. The other guy's working on a tourbillon, and he lays out every single piece individually in front of him, step by step, piece by piece. And when this guy cracks open the window, the gust of wind from the window blows everything on this guy's bench right off of it.
That sounds like a fight.
For me at the time, I was dying because the only thing you hear from the guy in front of me is this like non-masculine scream. It was like an extremely feminine scream, and everyone's like, "What the hell just happened?" So when you look up, you see this guy is just like screaming, like he's like grabbing his hair, he's like,
I have another story where one sneeze costs cost someone $1,000. So you know, you're working in kind of like a workshop environment setting, right? So there's like about 40 benches, right? So I sneeze pretty loud, right? So like one of those days, I just fucking couldn't hold the scream. So I was like, ah, too. Patrick was like, he came over to me at the end of the day, was like, Henry, your fucking scream caused me to fuck up a balanced hairspray I was working on for 8 hours. For like 4 hours, he's working on this like high complication. He's like, your fucking scream caused me to fuck the whole thing up.
Oh, his hand, I'm assuming his hands shake when you scream, and you just like destroyed the hairspray?
Homeboy was in a meditative zen light sig. The fucking sneeze took him right out. Took him and his hand tweezers right out of that.
Oh, you're one of those assholes I would hate to work with. Oh, man.
I'm like, I can't fucking control like the volume of my scream. It hurts me when I hold in the, oh no, the sneeze. Like, it hurts me when I hold my sneeze. So.
Ah, shit. Yeah, you're a prankster, dude. You got a lot of pranks. You're the type of person who...
Oh, there's more, man. There's many more. There's times where I will rearrange... I'm like fucking Jim in the office. I'll fucking rearrange every component in your drawers.
You know what this reminds me of?
Just come back from vacation, you're like, what the fuck happened to my back?
This reminds me of Dwight and Jim from The Office. Their pranks.
Yeah. Pretty much. Like, I have yet to put a nickel in a phone every like and condition them. There's some funny prank that goes on, and you probably have pranks yourself.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it's tough when you, because I worked with a bunch of old school immigrants, so for the most part, a lot of them didn't take the prank, but yeah, there are a lot of things that.
I would fuck with those old guys. I'm like, hey, you a watchmaker or a shoemaker? Why are you fucking that up for?
Oh, man.
I would always fucking rail on these guys. I had so much fun fucking when I was like working with, you know, other watchmakers.
Man,
you gotta have fun, right?
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that when you're working on watches the whole day, again, it's very monotonous. Don't get me wrong, the time flies by if you're working on something, that's pertaining to your skill level. But for the most part, sometimes it just gets boring. A lot of people don't really realize how, you know, sometimes you do need a little laughter in the middle of the day, you know?
Yeah. All right. I might lose you right now because...
Are you heading into a fucking office again?
Hopefully we don't. But, yeah, I need to... Order.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
All right. I think it's a good place to stop the podcast at anyway.
Yeah, I wanted to listen to some of your. Come on, you must have.
Yeah, I do have several. All
right, good. So go.
I'm gonna lose you.
I didn't lose you. Good. Wait. Took this in. No, we did. I didn't lose you. See? Mm. Good.
Let me see. I don't really have. I'm trying to think of my head. I don't. Maybe I'm blanking out right now, but I don't really remember anything else that was really really funny. I mean, I have some like self-deprecating stories.
That's depressing.
It was my mistake the entire time, only for me to like one time. Okay, this is self-deprecating, but it was hilarious to me because I laughed like the last. It was like I worked one whole day on a watch. I finished a watch in the morning. It was like 1 hour in. And I was able to complete the oiling and everything like that. And I was like, yeah, I'm killing it today. Like I'm working on this really good. Like everything was a breeze. Just when everything's going right, the flow is good. And I even poised the watch. I even did everything in terms of checking the time and everything. And then after I poised the watch and I timed the readings didn't get any better. And it was I couldn't understand why. And I spent the whole I'm literally talking about hours trying to find the problem, and it got to the point where I kept poising it too to balance it out. So finally, like I get off at 5 p.m. right, but finally by 4 p.m. I finally adjust the watch to the point where it is completely in tolerance. Only to realize 5 minutes later that I had poised the wrong locations in the balance wheel the entire time. And when I realized that, I was giggling to myself like an idiot, but it was more so like embarrassing. Like, I was very, very embarrassed. I was like, oh my God, this is a rookie mistake. But other than that, like, I don't really have any other good stories. I have some crazy stories.
No, we're trying to make, yeah. I'm trying to have a good laugh here. I'm trying to like set my day up for success. I'm not trying to like,
yeah, no, I'm just trying to think in my head. No, like I don't
stop
really...
story.
I don't really, I'm just trying to think in my head. Really? Like, I think for the most part, I don't like. Maybe I'm just blanking out.
You know, I've swapped out all of, you know, the screwdriver blades for.
Oh, you
for
are an asshole.
Before, if you go on vacation, I would. Let me see. You know what I hated though, right? Because I hated people who, when you were cleaning your watch, they would skip you.
Oh, like yeah.
You'd put your clean, watch yeah. cleaning, like you kind of like wait in line. Yeah, they would fucking skip you. So when people skip me, you know, secretly I just went in there and ended their cycle.
You ended the cycle on this cleaning machine.
The what you would say? I was like, yeah. You want to skip?
Okay.
You want to see? Like,
so just to
like,
get not just put, to give context, you know, for people, when you work in etiquette. A workshop and you have multiple watchmakers, sometimes these companies only have a couple cleaning machines for you to use. So when you're cleaning the watches, and the cleaning process could take from 45 minutes to an hour. So, you know, go figure. You're gonna have a backlog of people waiting to get their watches cleaned. So what Henry's saying is that when someone's cleaning their watch, a lot of times people put their cleaning baskets next to the cleaning machine. So that the people can it's you're practically in line for it.
It's like think about it like this: you're waiting in line in an amusement park, and someone goes and cuts the line. You're gonna think, "Fuck that guy." So when I was like, "It's my turn to clean it. Why is there another person?" I'm like, "All right, fuck this guy." I would stop the whole cleaning process. I would just like stop
on the cleaning machine, yeah, ACS 900.
So the ACS. Yeah, the ACS 900, 9000, whatever, it would stop, and then like it literally would be just the watch wouldn't be clean, right? So I would wait. I literally would wait till the guy times himself 40 minutes. He goes back to grabs his watch. He grabs it, brings it back to the desk. You know, demagnetizes the whole process. He takes everything out.
And he has
a puzzling look on his face, and he's looking at the watch like, this doesn't look clean. And then he turns around. I'm staring at the guy. Yeah.
Not in my head. You are terrible to work with. You are terrible to work with.
Don't be a fucking dick, right? That's the main
goal. Don't be a dick because there's always someone that's a bigger dick than you, huh?
Right. I don't know about that, right? But yeah, listen, I like, you know, like inequalities, you know, shit like this, like when people think they get away with stuff, like that's not cool. So, yeah, I try to do my part, however big or little it is. So,
dude, I have. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really. Have
you don't
much.
Have anything, really?
Honestly, yeah. I mean, I have a couple funny stories. I have like a scandal story. It's more like a scandal. Like one time, long story short, there was this old watchmaker, and there was this young service associate. You never knew, but we found out later on that the watchmaker, which was the old watchmaker, which was married, had an affair with the girl, and the wife found out. And what the wife did was she sent 8x10 photos of them together, of every explicit image of them together, and mailed it to all the boutiques, all the service centers, and everybody involved. So we came in one day to the workshop to mail in front of the door, and the mail is the pictures of this. It's literally just like 8x10 pictures of this guy and the girl together, and it was crazy. I mean, that's about the only thing I can think of right now. I don't really. Yeah, man. I guess I'm not as interesting as you.
This is why in your book you sound
shit,
so angry.
I mean, it's a
you
lot
gotta
of
have a laugh, man. You
it's just a lot of things
time,
to deal with.
Dude.
I mean, shit. If I worked with your ass, I'll probably write about you too. Fucking prick. Don't touch people's screwdrivers, man. That's true, but if you go on vacation and you said something snarky to me before
Dude,
you go on vacation,
there
that's
are people,
no, I will
there
fuck
I know people who when they go on vacation, they literally taped up their entire bench to make sure people don't steal their tools. Like, unfortunately, there's some
yep.
people who steal tools, and this guy literally taped up his entire bench with scotch tape, and he thinking that that was like the anti-theft magnet. He came back with all the tape removed and shit, and like some of his tools missing. I'm like, what did you expect? I'm like, you think that's actually going to deter people? Like, if someone's going to steal your shit, they're going to steal your shit. But yeah, no, man,
yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
Compared to your stories, I got blanks. Yeah.
Really? Shit, I have a story where some guy drilled a hole into his bench so he can put a lock on it, just so people
bench.
Wouldn't get through his shit. He drilled a hole
in his
motherfucking
bench, or is that the
and
company
put a
bench?
Bike chain around it.
Because if it's a company's bench, they should bill it.
It's a fucking company bench.
If someone drilled a hole in my bench that I provided,
it was a company
I'd be
bench.
Mad as shit.
Yeah, that's
all right.
To
well,
some extent.
I think we can call it quits here. I'll be sure to think about any funny stories I have and share in the next episode, I guess. Oh, did we just lose him? Perfect fucking timing. We lost him just as we're closing up, guys. All right, well, we're gonna end it here. If you guys need to visit Henry, you can look at the show notes in the below and find his links. You can find my links for Instagram and Facebook as well. And if you guys have not already, please like, subscribe, and give us a rating on iTunes. It just helps us out in terms of the ratings and exposure. And if we ever helped you out, if we answered any of your questions, just please link to us below. If you have any questions you want to submit in, reach out to us directly. And we'll feature you on the podcast as well. Thank you, guys. Hope you take care.